Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Chris Ballard, an award-winning journalist and longtime Sports Illustrated writer known for his deep narrative storytelling around human performance, resilience, and the pursuit of something more. His latest book, The Plunge, Maverick Swimmers, An Unlikely Quest and the Transformative Power of Cold Water, dives into the world of cold water immersion. It blends science and storytelling to explore how pushing the body into discomfort can reshape both mind and health. The book is available everywhere June 6th of this year, 2026. Chris, welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So let's start with your new book, Plunge. Pardon me. What first drew you to cold water as something worth exploring?
Personal desperation, Derek. Like many people who hit midlife and have spent their life being an athlete, the body starts to break down. And I ended up having a hip replacement at age 40. And this put me into a bit of a spiral. I had found my identity, my community, my joy, my stress release all came from sports. And so I wanted to keep going. And I knew I was going to have to adapt, but I was going to hold on to whatever I could. And through my work at Sports Illustrated, I was familiar with these NBA trainers. And one of them told me there's this new thing that all the players, Steph, LeBron, Giannis, are doing. And it's this extreme cold. And it didn't sound very novel to me, because I'd been doing icing for various parts of my body, you know, pretty much my entire life. And I'm not sure if it worked or not, but I always did it because people told you to do it. But in this case, it was full body. It was a cold plunge tub, often alternated with heat. So I tried it out and it bought me more time. I was able to go play in the old guy basketball game. I was happy again. And I started to look into this cold water trend that had started to catch on, where people were buying cold plunge tubs. And it was, you know, everyone from Joe Rogan to Ed Sheeran to Kate Middleton was doing this. And I became cold curious. And like many people, it was started with cold showers. And I moved on to the cold plunge. And then I got really deep into it. And that's when I started doing this ice swimming. So it was the full immersion, pun intended.
That's great. That's great. So how do you define cold plunging? There's everything from ice baths to, you know, used by athletes, as you mentioned, to polar bear plunges on New Year's Day. What falls under that umbrella, really?
So the starter pack, so to speak, is taking a hot shower. And then at the very end of that hot shower, just turning it cold for 30 seconds. And this is something that James Bond would do in the James Bond books, you know, called a James Bond shower or a Scottish shower. And that'll give you this little boost at the end of your shower. So that technically qualifies, you know, some people call it cold water exposure, which is a fancy way of saying just, you know, you're getting in cold water. And then the next would be, you know, going and jumping in a lake, but maybe it's not quite summer yet, so it's a little bit chilly and your body has that reaction, a little bit of maybe a little hyperventilation, a little, ooh, you know, you hurry back to your towel. And then the gradation goes down to where you're getting into water that might be 55 degrees or 45 degrees, or the real hardcore plungers will do it at 40 degrees and under. And that's where you just activate all these bodily systems. It's a fight or flight situation. And then the pointy extreme of that is people who will go and do open water swimming in cold water. And then it's a, you know, you're talking 15, 20, 30 minutes, and you're mixing in the exercise with the cold exposure.
Sure. Sure. Interesting. So from your reporting and your own experience, because you've tried it, obviously, what actually happens in the body during cold exposure that might be relevant to aging or older adults?
Oh, it's fascinating. And this is all, I'll try not to go on too long here, Derek. So the first thing that happens is you get in that cold water and your body senses a threat. And that makes sense. And so it activates the fight or flight system the same way that if a tiger strolled into your living room, you would get this giant dump of adrenaline and dopamine, because your body wants to prepare for this threat. Your body doesn't know that this is just a lake. You know, it sees this as an imminent threat. So you get this huge surge, up to 530% rise in adrenaline. And so you are just ready to go. You're alert. You are in cold water. You're also hyperventilating a bit in that situation. And so the first thing that happens is all your stress levels rise. Your cortisol jumps up. Your heart rate jumps up. Your blood pressure jumps up. And if you were to extend that, that would not necessarily be good for you. But after about 90 seconds, the second part kicks in and you become remarkably calm because now your body is conserving. It's like, okay, this is a threat, but the threat here is maybe prolonged exposure. So we're going to bring all the blood to the core. We're going to slow the heart rate. And so researchers have looked into this, and it's meditation might get you there, but it's really the only reliable way to become both alert and calm simultaneously. And if you do this repeatedly, you know, once a week, whatever it might be, you'll end up seeing that your cortisol levels, your stress levels will go down. Your resting heart rate will eventually go down, and you will be able to become more resilient both to stress and often in a lot of cases, anecdotally, your emotional regulation gets better. So it's this idea of what some people call hormesis, where if we do micro stresses to our body, because we're all in like climate controlled houses and climate controlled cars, and our lives have become incredibly easy. And so if you can find these small, healthy ways to stress you, you will become more resilient long term. And there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, you could exercise, you could do high intensity interval training, for example, will do this. But for some people, that's harder as you age. Like going, you know, full bore sprints is a challenging thing to do. Here is something that really, as long as you mentally can do it, you know, turn that shower to cold for 60 seconds. That's it. So the barrier to entry is very low, and the payoff, and we can get into this a little bit, but you'll see it, association with longevity, association with positive mental health. There are a lot of positives to this. The only thing I would say immediately is that if you have a pre-existing heart condition, cold plunges are something you shouldn't do until you check with your doctor.
Makes sense. Certainly, there is a lot of discussion around cold plunging, and what's real versus overstated when it comes to actual health benefits. Now, you know, you had a really important caution there about people with perhaps a heart condition, but talk a little about the real versus overstated.
Sure, that's with any trend. What you're going to see is people finding ways to take this and ascribe new benefits to it. That definitely happened with cold plunging. And part of the reason we don't know the exact answer to that question is because there hasn't been a lot of high-level research. There's been research, but because there's no monetary outcome to this, so if you were to, you know, spend tens of millions of dollars rigorously studying the effects of cold on the body, at the end, you wouldn't be able to produce a drug. There's no reason for a drug company to invest in this. So the research that has been done is really interesting, but it needs more evidence to it. So where does that leave? It leaves a little white space for people to infer other benefits. So for example, the idea that you won't get sick if you cold plunge. If you cold water swim, you won't get sick. It does. We've seen it can help your immune system. And anecdotally, people will talk about this idea that they get sick less often, but we don't know that for sure. There's also an idea that you will lose weight by cold plunging. And you would, but you would have the duration of time that you'd have to cold plunge for. The ice swimming community that I joined into, they will lose weight in part because you end up shivering. And shivering is this really powerful metabolic burn. You can actually get up to 46% of your aerobic capacity just by shivering. Now we're talking like your whole body is shaking, right? So that sure. type of yep. shivering. So there are areas where you could take, you know, a kernel of truth and push it out. And that's what's happened in some cases.
Interesting. Makes sense. So is discomfort like cold something that we should intentionally be reintroducing as we age?
Yes, 100%. I can attest this myself. I'm now in my early 50s, and I found, I was a parent. And so I had stress in my life from work and parenting, all the normal stuff, right? But it certainly wasn't good stress. It wasn't helping me sleep at night. And so finding ways to introduce this, there's a difference between what they call distress and eustress. And distress is negative stress. If you smoke cigarettes, that's a negative stress. If you don't sleep a lot, that's a negative stress. Eustress is positive stress that you choose. And that's a big important element of it is if I'm choosing to get into this cold water, if I'm choosing to go for a you know, a run, whatever it is, this, you know, it could be, you know, a little bit of exercise. It could be cold exposure. There's heat exposure as well. Like saunas, we've seen some of this. It will provide a lot of benefits to us, but I feel like it probably becomes harder as we age to make that decision to introduce that discomfort, because we become really set in our ways. It's really easy not to. It's really easy just to, hey, I'm going to, you know, I'll watch a movie today and I'll go on my normal walk and I got my routine. And that's where I was. I was in midlife and I had hit this routine and I was super comfortable. And without this book to push me, I probably wouldn't have done half these things. And I saw this remarkable physical transformation, emotional transformation in the period of 3 years reporting this book, because I was forced out of my comfort zone pretty much daily.
That's great. And, you know, interesting to use the term comfort zone, which, you know, is obviously common vernacular, but it is probably human nature to not seek discomfort, right? And to try to stay in areas that are, you know, somewhat easy. But I recognize how important it is to make sure that we're always challenging ourselves physically, mentally, you know, in whatever capacity.
Yeah, I think one of the best pieces of advice that you hear everywhere is do one new thing every day, right? And that can be as simple as just driving a different route, but don't put the maps on, right? drive a route where you have to intuit how to get somewhere. And cold plunging is a great example of that. That's incredibly accessible. Sure. I think there's a lot of correlation between some of the cold water swimming and endurance sports, marathoners, these kind of things. And you'll see that marathoning is something you can do as you get older. But for someone like me, you know, with an artificial hip and bad joints, it's not really an option anymore. But swimming is a great sport you can do up until your 90s. And cold exposure is something that will also keep helping you. So it is it's an avenue for people to find that discomfort in their life and do it in 5 minutes. And I think that there's the thing that I would take away and tell someone, and it doesn't have to be cold water, right? Whatever this discomfort is, whatever this little stress is, you may not enjoy doing it. It's sort of like writing. Writers know this. There's a saying like, it sucks to write, it's great to have written. And I think these stressors are the same way, right? You may not necessarily always enjoy that thing, but you're always happy afterwards.
Sure. Sure. I love that. So you were just bringing up swimming. You've said that it's a best activity for older adults for a lot of reasons. Talk more about that.
Yeah, I didn't recognize all this prior to reporting this book, because I'd never been a swimmer. And so the more I got into it, the more interested I was as an older athlete myself. So you start just with the fact that there's no joint tear. You're not putting pressure on Achilles. You're not putting pressure on your knee. A lot of the elements for athletes that go the first, cartilage, range of motion, you're not going to do any of it. You know, the shoulder is the only joint that's going to be under any kind of stress, and there are ways to adapt to that. I've actually found a modified stroke in the reporting the book that took the stress off my shoulder. So number one, you're just not going to have wear and tear, right? Number two, the compression that you get from being in the water actually helps your circulation. So if you think about it, whether it's a bathtub, a hot tub, getting into pool, there's this subtle compression that comes from the water that helps your circulation. And they've also seen that just being horizontal also has beneficiary effects. So there's something called shear stress that happens in your arteries. It's complicated, but essentially what it means is this helps your cardiovascular system, your arterial system function better, which is incredibly important as we age, right? And then finally, you know, there is an advantage as we age. Often some people will gain weight. There's actually an advantage when you're swimming to having weight on. So if I'm running, every extra pound I have just adds more pressure to my joints. It makes it harder to run. Swimming, if you are very lean, you actually have the issue of trying to keep your hips up in the water. You're constantly fighting to keep your hips up. And if you're Michael Phelps and you're swimming, you know, 50 meters, that's not an issue. But if you're swimming 40 laps, you're spending a lot of time trying to keep those hips up. Whereas if your body fat is closer to 20 to 30%, you actually become neutrally buoyant. And you can flow through the water. And that's what some of these really good open water swimmers will carry more body fat than others. So it's incredibly open to all body types.
Wow. So you've also seen that older athletes can be more successful than younger ones when it comes to cold water and ice swimming. What are some of the reasons for that?
This is what I found really fascinating, Derek. And I'll paraphrase. Am I allowed to swear on the podcast?
Sure.
Okay. So I was surprised to find in this really extreme sport. So ice swimming is water that is 41 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. So it's cold, cold. And to swim in that kind of water, you don't get a wetsuit. You just have a little silicone cap. You get a swimsuit. You get goggles and earplugs. So it's an extreme sport in the same way that, you know, climbing Everest isn't an extreme thing that someone might do. Big wave surfing. And we generally correlate these with younger people, right? But a lot of the best ice swimmers and a lot of the community that I entered into the last couple of years was 50 plus. And I'm talking up to 85. And what they found was, one, this was something really extreme, not only extreme, but something that came with a sense of challenge and accomplishment that you can do later in life. And second, that they were prepared for it. And what I mean by that is there's this Irish ice swimmer named Jer Kennedy, and he explained it to me. He's in his 50s, and he's like, you know, I went through a divorce. I got fired. My knee gave out, and in his case, he had to have a replacement as well. And life just got more and more complicated, and I endured more stuff. And by the time I started doing this ice swimming, I had built up this really powerful endurance brain. And in essence, what he was saying was like, the more hard shit you do, the easier it is to do hard shit. So for a lot of these people, if you're 65 and you've lived this full life and you've gone through a lot, the idea of swimming in ice water is not as frightening or not as overwhelming as it is to some 20-year-old who maybe has had a nowhere near those challenges in life at this point.
That makes sense. The endurance on all levels. And, when life knocks you down, it's important to have some of those skills and tools to tap into. I can only imagine.
For sure. Yeah.
So cold water forces a very immediate confrontation with discomfort, as we've talked about. What did it teach you about the psychology of resilience, and how might that translate to the rest of our lives? Not unlike what you were, sharing with in the anecdote just prior.
Yeah. So there's the one is the earned endurance. I think that's part of it. And the second is continually surprising yourself. And I think that was the big takeaway for me as I started this. I was not a swimmer. I'm not a cold guy. I actually own a hot tub. And so I got into this, and the concept that I would actually compete at ice swimming was mind blowing. And I'm like, it's a step too far for me. I'm just going to report this book. I'm going to write about other people. And then the national team coach for the U.S. national team for ice swimming, there is such a thing. He's like, Chris, if you're going to write about it, you sort of got to try it. And I'm like, oh, Joe, I think you're right. And so I was entered in the U.S. National Championships. It was an open event. So I entered in it. And I recall standing on the edge of that pool before my first race, and the water was 38 degrees, and there's this whole crowd, and it's being live streamed. And at that point, you really can't back out. Like, you're not walking back up that ladder. And so I was really unsure what was going to happen. Could I do this? I had so many things in my head telling me that, just say you're a reporter, just say you're that, back out. And then the feeling, it was like 2 minutes later after I got out from my 100-meter swim, the feeling of accomplishment, but also of, oh, wow, like the old dog still got it. That, right. I think that's what I took away from it was, I think we sometimes limit ourselves as we age in terms of what we think we can do based on our prior experience. And that to me was the seeing all these people who had taken up this sport or who had just found a new way to find themselves or find a new community. Even we get set in our ways with our community, and it's here, okay, I'm going to find this new world that I can enter, these new connections. And that's not something I thought I could do, but turns out I can.
That's wonderful. So did you notice, as you're doing your reporting, differences in how younger versus older people approach fear and discomfort?
I did. And I mean, obviously, we're painting with a broad brush here. So, but I saw there was an adventure aspect to it for people when they were younger. But it felt like I'm going to do this once, right? I'm going to prove I can do this. So I'm going to get in that water. I'm going to pop out of it. Maybe I'll film myself for social media, And you know, it's like eating a really spicy pepper. You do it once, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. That's like, keep doing that in life as well. What I saw with the older people was a more considered approach to it, right? So obviously there's more preparation that goes into it, but there's more ability to maybe be present in the moment and present afterwards, and often a feeling of gratitude. A gratitude, you know, one of the swimmers I write about, he talks about the sense of being fully in the body. That's you amazing. Just, all this mental swirl we often have, it cuts out. And he can be fully in his body, and he appreciates that at a level that I know I didn't when I was 20 years old.
Sure, sure. That's great. So in The Plunge, your new book, there's this idea that your body reacts instantly, but your mind has to catch up and decide to stay in. That feels like a broader metaphor for taking on hard things. Do you think there's a mindset shift required to keep pushing boundaries as we age?
100%. And the question, of course, is how do we get there? Adam Grant, who's an organizational psychologist, I thought had the best description of this. He talked about when he was in high school, he wanted to play basketball. He didn't make the basketball team. So he decided he was going to be a diver, you know, diving off the springboard. And he was afraid of heights. So it was a bit of an issue for him, but he stuck with it. And there was one point where he stood on that diving board for 45 minutes.
Wow.
And finally, his coach said, "Are you going to jump in?" And he said it was that day that he realized you don't need confidence to take action. It's the inverse. It's that by taking action, we build confidence.
Hmm. Interesting.
And I feel like that's something I'm going to try to remember every day in my life. That it's not like, oh, I need to do all these steps to do this thing. Sometimes it's doing the thing that allows you to do the next thing.
Sure. That's amazing. That's certainly a profound life lesson.
Yeah.
So that's great. So this is a question that every Roundtable Talk guest gets. What are you looking forward to as you age?
The wisdom. That's what I see in my parents and the people that I know who are older. I love sitting with them and talking with them and seeing the perspective. I'm in my mid-50s, so I feel like I'm starting to get there. I'm still in a little bit of the rush hour of life with teenage kids and enjoying it. But I feel like that's the ability to see the bigger picture, that it continues to build as we get older. And that's, to me, is sort of the purpose of it all.
Sure. No, that's important. And I would imagine that you are, uniquely positioned to gain wisdom through your reporting, through your discussions, through your research. Not that others aren't, but you're constantly out there trying to, I would imagine curiosity is a lot at the core of who you are and of your job. But, you know, talk a little about that, if you would, just in finding that wisdom or creating opportunities to gather wisdom.
Yeah. That was what drew me to journalism in the first place, was this ability to talk to really interesting people, find out what made them tick, find out the how. I always love talking to basketball players, and they're accustomed to answering these questions with sound bites, you know, some cliches, you know, 110%. I enjoyed saying, "No, Kobe, I want to talk about, I watched you take a jab step, and I noticed that you jabbed further to the right than you did last season." And he'd say, "Oh, that's because," and you'd find these mechanisms that led these people to be really good at something. And often we can draw something from that. So for me, that has been the great joy of all this, is getting to talk to people who have either taken real chances in their life. Sometimes it's the opposite, people who have gone through unendurable things, but the perspective that they gained, that if they're willing to share it with us, allows us to get a sense for a life that we haven't lived, but we get to be tourists for a moment in that life.
Sure, sure. So you just mentioned Kobe. I'm sure you've had some amazing conversations with some, really fascinating people. Are there a couple of those, a couple life lessons that you could share from some of those conversations, be it, you know, big names or not?
Yeah, and I'll talk specifically about basketball because there's three players that are generational players that I was lucky enough to cover. And each of them, for me, provided a different lesson. And so the first was Kobe. I started my career at Sports Illustrated essentially the same time as Kobe did. So I ended up doing a lot of stories on him. And Kobe had, he created his own mythology to a certain extent, but he really was incredibly calculating in a way that led to success. And incredibly intentional about how he did things. He was a great interview. And so you could sit and, like we talked about, you could talk about that jab step forever. But he also had a larger goal for the interview. So he wasn't just answering your questions. Kobe, the same way maybe like a business leader would, he had an overarching goal or a politician. And Kobe did all throughout his career. And so by the time he got to his retirement, he had like created a legacy in real time. And he'd created a mythology in real time. And so watching him was sort of like seeing someone who understood the value of creating a larger-than-life persona early. The second would be LeBron James. And for him, his recall and his interest in recalling specific moments in basketball is off the charts. You could ask him about a game 6 years ago, a regular season game, and he could tell you about some of the plays that he ran, about what went wrong, why something worked. And obviously part of that is a natural ability. But with LeBron, it also meant that he cared so deeply about the game. And I always respected that about LeBron. And you'll see it, I mean, we're talking right as he has led the Lakers at age 41 to the brink of a series victory against the Rockets, which is remarkable. So you can't fake that. There's no, yeah. And the third is Steph Curry. And I happened to cover his very first game, and I'm based in the Bay Area, so I got to spend a lot of time with Steph. And I remember talking to other sports writers those first few years, and we'd seen it happen before. Someone comes in the league, and they have either a joy or a naivete, and like, oh, I hope he doesn't lose it, right? I hope he doesn't become jaded. I hope the world doesn't beat him down. And here's Steph, and he's 38, and he hasn't lost it. And that's remarkable. I mean, I recall going over to his apartment early in his career and showing up, and we were doing an interview, but Steph was worried because he wanted to get to Whole Foods first to buy groceries and flowers for his then girlfriend, now wife. And he brought him in, and he was so human. And we sat down and we played pool and we talked, but unlike Kobe, he had no motive for the conversation. Steph was just sort of happy to share. And I think a little bit to help me, which was a remarkable thing to see in an athlete who was being, so many people were asking him for something and he was willing to give.
That's great. I love those stories. Thank you for sharing that. So as we discussed before we started our conversation, you'd written your first article for National Geographic last fall titled How to Grow Older and Fitter Like a Champion. Talk a little about that experience.
Wonderful experience. I was one of those kids that always had National Geographic on the coffee table growing up. I'd always wanted to write for the magazine. And this focus was on something, idea of athletic mortality, which is that there's a point in our life where generally we can't do that thing we love anymore. And how do you prepare for that moment? And what do you do after? And this story ended up being a little bit of a rebuttal to that concept because some of the people in the story had pivoted. So you hit a point where you can't do triathlons, you find a new thing you can do, right? And some of the people had really just gone their whole life not exercising. And so it was interesting to trace their stories. Nora Langdon, I think, was the most affecting one. She was a woman who had hit 60 and gained a lot of weight. And she'd been a real estate agent. And she found that just walking up the stairs at these houses she was showing, she would get out of breath. And she started to worry about the long-term effect on her health of this. And a friend of a friend recommended her to a trainer who brought her to a gym. And he literally started her on a bench with a broomstick, bench pressing a broomstick. And those first three times wore her out. And she was like, never again. I'm not going back to that gym. I'm not doing this. But she went back. A little voice inside her kept her going back. And she ended up making the broomstick to an actual bar, then a bar with weight on the side, and ended up becoming within 5 years a national champion powerlifter. And she is now in her early 80s and still powerlifting. And she credits this with her longevity, the quality of her life, this ability to have confidence in herself. She's got all these medals. It's wonderful to see. And so the story was looking at four people who provided a little bit of inspiration for the rest of us to find that next route.
It was a great piece. I appreciate your kind of sharing that those stories with the world.
Thank you.
So let's go all the way back now to a book you wrote in 2006 called The Butterfly Hunter, which is about people who find their calling off the beaten path in life. Did any of the stories in that book involve later in life careers?
Midlife, I would say. So some of the people in this book focused on people who had often started in an office job or something that they were doing for the money or because they thought they were supposed to, but they had this nagging passion, something that really excited them. So one of the people in the book was a lumberjill. This is one of those women who uses the axe and she competes, and she had a tattoo of the Statue of Liberty holding an axe on her arm. And so she, you know, cut down trees and did chainsaws. Another was the most successful voiceover guy in Hollywood, Don LaFontaine. He was that deep voice, you know, in a world before, in a time before. Looking at these people and finding what was it about this choice of career that drew them to it, and then what did they gain from it? And I think what I saw was it was that ability to say, okay, this may seem weird to other people, but it's what makes me happy. And this may be your hobby. It may be something you enjoy doing. But what if you tried to make it your actual career? What would that look like? And I think the answer was there was no day that these people weren't excited to go to work. Now, you know, there are realities to work. You know, you got to get it paid. You got to get a healthcare, all these other things. So, but they were willing to chase this dream because it brought them joy. And to me at the time, as a younger writer, that seemed to be the goal. What is the thing I can do that I wake up every morning excited to do, and I can actually call my job?
That's great. What a gift when you find that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So why do you think so many people feel boxed in from pursuing new passions as they grow older?
I think it's a sense of a cemented identity we have, the person that we have become. And it seems like a lot, I know this myself, it starts to feel like that's just who you are and will be. And so taking that chance and moving outside of this identity you've created, that takes courage. And you know, it might be that it's how your kids see you, it's how your friends see you, it's how your work peers see you, and you've attained a level of success and acumen. And to try something new often requires going to the bottom, starting cold. And so now you're a novice again. And with that comes a hit to your confidence. So that ability to say, okay, I'm doing this knowing there are values and virtues that will come out of doing this hard thing. But they're not going to come right away. And for a while, I will be that struggling novice. That's hard to do, but man, is it powerful.
That's great. So did reporting that book change how you think about career timelines or even expiration dates?
Yeah, I think the, you know, retire at 65 concept is what these people went against. These are people who are going to keep doing this as long as they can. An example I'll give you is a gentleman who legally changed his name to Spider-Man. His name is Spider-Man Mulholland. And he made high-level repairs in places that traditional machinery couldn't get to. So if there's a skyscraper, for example, and there's a repair needed high up in the skyscraper, they might drop him in via helicopter to the top, and then he'd rappel down the side, make the repair, and then wall walk to the bottom. And of course, he also, I think, enjoyed the attention that came with this. But he was a guy who was a bit of an adrenaline junkie, and he loved doing things that seemed impossible. And so he lived his whole life that way. During our reporting, any stairs we came upon, the stairs into a mini mart, you know, stairs to his apartment building, we ran them. So I got in really good shape following this guy around. And he had found a way to be like, this is who I am. This is what I love doing. How do I make that a job? So that really I found inspiring.
Sure. And I guess if you legally change your name to Spider-Man, you kind of have to keep doing that, right?
Yes. Right. Yeah.
So many of the people in The Plunge and The Butterfly Hunter seem driven by something deeper. What role does purpose play in longevity?
Where do we find our purpose feels like the question that matters. So if we're young, there's obvious purpose laid out. You need to figure out your life. You need to get a career. You need to do these things, right? Oh, then you need to have, if you're going to have kids, then you need to have kids and you have to be a good parent. It's that point, which I'm now hitting. I'm in the mid-50s, where suddenly some of these driving purposes start to dissipate. So where do you find it? You know, and I think the entry route I saw that most effective in reporting this book was be a community. So finding a community, and it really didn't matter what that community was doing, as long as they held you accountable and provided a sense of shared value, shared ambition around it. So, you know, this could be your hiking group, right? In this case, the cold water had a really beneficial effect because going through it, if you all go jump in the bay on a Saturday morning at 9 a.m., that's a relatively traumatic experience if you're not used to cold water. And so there's this shared trauma. You all did this hard thing together. You sit on your blanket afterwards. You have a cup of tea. You talk with people. Boom. Now, is that, you know, a life's purpose? No, but these small things, that's what helps you plan your weekend, that it helps you get a sense of, oh, I did this hard thing.
Sure. No, that's great. And, you know, we all know that social isolation is an epidemic, you know, in society, but particularly for older adults. And that's so important for them.
And in fact, the through line of the book ended up being different than I expected. And it was the mental health benefits to this, especially, for example, among men in the UK, where depression rates are super high ever since the pandemic, but maybe they're not open to an idea like therapy. But here's an active thing you do. It's like, cool, you go with other guys, but you're not necessarily going to go find these guys otherwise. But if you meet and you do this plunge together, you hang out afterwards, it creates that instant bond. And it's harder the older we get to have those bonds and to seek them out.
Absolutely. No, that makes a whole lot of sense. It is important and critical. But so for someone in their 50s or 60s or beyond, what's a realistic way to start introducing more adventure or novelty into their life?
Pick something that scares you. And we talked about this concept of, you know, navigating without the map, right? So, but pick something that scares you and do it. And the more you do that, the more of a habit that becomes. So it really, like, what is it? It doesn't have to be, you know, skydiving. but I think that novelty is what's going to keep us feeling as if there is a challenge ahead. I've seen that with my own parents. Like, what is the next challenge? What is the next challenge? Because that's what makes you feel alive.
Sure, sure. So if there's one mindset or habit from your reporting that people should adopt for a longer, more fulfilling life, what would that be?
This is one that I experienced myself in the reporting process over 3 years, where it was, I came in, I felt like an outsider, and I felt like I was reporting on this world. And then I became part of the world, and I started swimming, and I did things that I never would have thought I could do. And so the lesson for me was never underestimate yourself. I think especially as we age, it gets easier and easier. That's not something I can do anymore. I know that's how I felt going through
this. Sure. Interesting. So, you know, you've had a storied career as an author, as a journalist, as an investigative reporter, not in the whole sense of, you know, probably that kind of investigative journalism, but nonetheless, you've been investigating a lot of topics. What's next?
Hopefully another book. Keep writing stories, keep talking to interesting people. Keep finding a way, hopefully, to both illuminate subjects and entertain people. I think that's always the goal, is to dive into a world that maybe you wouldn't normally go into and bring back, you know, stories and a little bit of wisdom.
That's great. That's great. So last question, what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
I think to be aware in the moment of the value of relationships. It gets easy when you're young to assume there's going to be this constant stream of people you're going to meet in your life. And it's just going to, you know, one's going to lead to the next. And then the older I've gotten and the more I've seen these people in these communities of ice swimmers and cold plungers do this as well. It's recognizing and being grateful for these long run relationships, because those are the ones that you're really going to treasure. You know, the older you get, the people that knew you when. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but boy, is it true, right?
Absolutely. No, well said. Well, we've been talking with Chris Ballard. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And I'd also like to thank Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. I'm Derek Dunham, and we'll see you next time on Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you so much, Derek.